Well, because of time constraints here, I will opt to not start Coast to Coast AM like we usually do on Saturday nights. This is Ian Punnett. In fact, I could do a longer crypto news piece about some events that are happening, and there's some very interesting. Well, because of time constraints here, I will opt to not start Coast to Coast AM like we usually do on Saturday nights. This is Ian Punnett. In fact, I could do a longer crypto news piece about some events that are happening, and there's some very interesting ones. I will refer you only to the website at coasttocoastam.com. And if you click onto my blog, you'll see a couple of things for today, a couple of fun links from today. And I want to acknowledge something up front about the next couple of hours for many of you who say that you think this show is coming too soon after the zombie war, after World War Z. Let me say up front, I understand why many of you are sensitive about that. In some cases, some sectors of this country and some nations around the world are still battling the living dead in limited amounts, fortunately. And there are some strong opinions in this country about how our government and various religious organizations, just to name a few, behaved during the zombie war, or as it is known commonly, World War Z. I want to talk about the zombie war. I want to be one of the first shows to sort out the strengths and weaknesses of our country during this long and particularly dreadful experience. I want to be open with you and say I will be as non-political and non-judgmental about the behavior of certain well-known politicians during World War Z as we can possibly be on the show and still be honest. As for, you know, how certain countries behaved around the world, that, you know, because all of our communications were cut off for so long, I'm still just getting the whole picture. That's why the book, really the first authoritative history of World War Z, is out. Max Brooks is the author. It's an oral history of the zombie war, which, you know, is different in that he's not attempting to be empirical about everything that happened, but rather kind of reflect the difficulty of this human international crisis through, you know, anecdotal accounts and people's individual experiences. Plus, you know, as an author, as a historian here, pulling it all together so that we have a better picture of what happened. But it's still not the complete picture. That I'll acknowledge up front. So if you're hearing some of these stories about the zombie war and you're thinking, that's not what I heard. You know, I heard from somebody else who let me know, you know, when I was, you know, in a detention camp somewhere, or if you were one of the lucky people who happened to be in one of the good zones here in the United States, you know, west of the Rockies, where the government was able to kind of quarantine the population to a point. You know, consider yourself lucky that you've got more reliable information than a lot of other people who are just catching the show tonight. But for everybody else who is unfamiliar with exactly what happened over the course of the zombie war, and you think you can handle an honest accounting of it, stand by. This is going to be, you know, a show to remember on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, before I bring up Max Brooks here, who's the author of this new oral history of World War Z, I want to give a little background on my experience with this, as some of you who are listening tonight have been kind of unable to listen to this show for a while. So you sort of have missed already a lot of the information that you would have liked to have had during this very scary period in both our national and international history. You know, some of you might know that by kind of a fluke, when the zombie epidemic was just beginning to hit, my wife and I had just sold our house and we were planning on taking the summer off. So we were pretty liquid. We had bought an Airstream trailer. We had outfitted it with a small microphone processor that connected us back to the Coast to Coast studios in LA via a satellite phone, which we were just planning on using for the summer. And it was really just going to be sort of a fun thing to be able to kind of enjoy being free and out on the road. Well, it ended up being very fortuitous, and I'm very grateful that we were in that kind of a position. We know many others who didn't make it through this period because they stayed behind to try to fight for their home, or because they had a sort of a misguided sense of being able to fight this off on their own. You know, when the zombie epidemic hit, it caught a lot of us off guard because it had already grown to a point that it was, you know, probably almost a tipping point against, you know, those of us that were living. We just didn't know it yet. Many of you listening to the show know, you know, your own story well, but you couldn't hear it because power wasn't back on in your own sector until finally getting a local affiliate up and running to carry the show. So let me just, you know, also bring you up a little bit on the show and just say, George Norrie, I think, did a fabulous job. He was fortunately in L.A. and not in St. Louis with his family when things really got bad. Thank you to Premier Radio Networks for having invested in those bunkers. And Art Bell, who was in the Philippines, was able to stay connected to us for a very long time and continue his broadcasts pretty regularly, reflecting a whole other area of the world and what they were struggling with. We haven't yet made contact again with Art, but we look forward to hearing from him and knowing that he and his family are well. And I don't think we'll have a chance to take many phone calls tonight from you all. So let me just say, maybe this is the first of a couple conversations we can have with Max Brooks. He was originally brought on to be the author of the United Nations post-war commission report, but had a conflict with how they were writing it. You know, that's kind of a whole nother story, as many of us don't really accept the way the post-war commission report was written. And Max, can you talk a little bit about that, about how you thought the post-war commission report should have been written in the first place?
Yes, I can, and good to be here. I can say that the UN Commission was, from a positive point of view, unbiased and thorough and accurate. But it was remiss in denying what I like to call the human factor, the emotions and the personal stories. They were much more concerned with the facts and figures. How many died? When did they die? Where did they die?
What do you think? What was behind that? I mean, some people have said, and certainly got said on this show for a period of time after the report came out, that they were trying to cover up the true horror of it by just trying to stick to the numbers.
Well, I think just by sticking to the numbers, they were trying. I believe that they thought it was in everyone's best interest to look past the emotion. I think they believe that had we been a little more dispassionate before the crisis got out of hand, it might not have gotten out of hand in the first place. I think they were trying to be logical and rational, but by this point, the horse was out of the barn.
Right.
There was no
point. Yeah. And they couldn't have known that. And we're just, I think many of us are just beginning to understand how bad things were before it became almost the death knell for humanity. And so perhaps then you can fill us in on some of these blanks tonight. Like the very first, the patient zero, the very first case of, you know, what some people call, what are the various names for it? Besides zombieism, what were some of the things that people called the very first case of the walking dead? What do they call it?
Well,
the walking plague.
There was African rabies that was that was misdiagnosed.
Right.
That was one of them. There was various plagues, as you said, walking plague. Pretty much every culture, every country, every organization had a different name.
But the first one, do we know for sure that the first case was in China?
No, we don't. You have to remember, when we talk about the first case, we're only talking about the first known case.
Can you talk about what we know about that case? What did you find as a historian, as an oral historian, at least to get us closer to the seminal event of the zombie war?
Well, I think automatically we know that the first case was not the first case, because the Chinese government clearly already knew and already had a plan in place. And how would they have if this was the first case? So I think that was the most important thing that we found.
That's interesting, right? We certainly didn't know that. So they had had some, either out of superstition, out of some what had maybe have been considered by some to be folklore, or because they had had previous actual scientific knowledge of it, they were already preparing for a zombie outbreak in China.
Exactly. Clearly, they knew something at the highest levels of government, which might have been years in the making, or it might have been months. We simply do not know.
Anything in the plans that were drawn up by the Chinese government, and this, we're talking about the old Chinese government, back when they were communist, before the war, do we know anything in the plans that indicate how, if they knew the origin of it, was it a virus? Was it something that came down from space? I mean, did they give any indication at all that they were already working on a cure, or had isolated, you know, the catalyst which created the Walking Dead?
No, the Chinese government at the time dealt with the problem the way they dealt with any problem, which was to simply exterminate the carriers, which fit into very classic Maoist philosophies of how to deal with an opposing ideology.
And so they did this through establishing, like, local reporting through neighborhood doctors, that kind of a thing. And if they found somebody, they rounded them up and they just dispatched them.
Well, the genius of the Chinese was they did not try to hide their sweeps. They just hid what they were sweeping for. They knew they could not hide those kinds of sweeps, that the world would be watching. And so they simply invented a cover-up, that they were sweeping for dissidents, they were sweeping for counter-revolutionaries. So when the trucks would roll in the middle of the night, people were taken out and never came back, there was an explanation.
And the people they were taking away, I mean, this is really key, because I think we as human beings, we're unprepared for when somebody that we either know to be or suspect to be dead is still living, to think that somehow they've turned into a zombie. I mean, our first, you know, thought is to somehow contextualize this in a way in which we can understand it. So we would say they have a disease, they have leprosy, they have something, they're mentally, you know, incapacitated, there's something. But people were attempting to try to deal with them as though they were living. They didn't really understand that these were zombies.
No, and that's the case with any new plague. That this is nothing new. This is how we as humans deal. We deal with something new as if it were old.
Right. We go to the familiar. But this didn't work. So tell me, what do we know to be? What's the story of the person that we, at least we can make a guess at being one of the earliest known victims? What do we know about them, him or her?
Well, all we know is that this little boy and his father were diving for relics in the lake created by the Three Gorges Dam. And we don't know what happened. We know the father disappeared. We know the boy came up with a bite on his foot. And from that point, it spread. And that's all we know.
Well, and that becomes very important, too. It would have been handy to have that kind of information up front, because then we would have had a better idea of the ability of zombies to survive underwater.
Would have saved a lot of lives.
Yeah. All right, now, so let's just fast forward a little bit. So how long did it take for the numbers in China alone to start getting out of hand? What year were we talking about, and how long was it before they began to alert the international community that they had a problem that was bigger than they could handle?
They never alerted the international
community. Ever. Never did.
Never. It was never an option.
Not unofficially, not under the table, never.
No.
They just never said it. Ugh, that is so criminal.
They never did.
So when does the word start to get out?
Well, it started with the Warmbrand Knight Report, which was an Israeli Mossad analyst and an ex-CIA officer, which tried to sound the alarm. And, of course, that was ignored. by everyone, of course, except Israel.
Was that because of the satellite photos? Is that what they were doing, or?
No, it was simply that that Israel and Taiwan have always had a close relationship. They were testing encryption software, and they knew that they kept seeing the word zombie, and they naturally thought it was a code word for something else until they realized that it actually meant what it said.
Now, China later on tries to blame this whole thing on Taiwan, don't they?
Well, that was part of the cover-up, was to try to launch a sweep for counter-revolutionaries, and that was going to be explaining their sweep for the dead.
Gosh. So what's the year? What year is it that when we first finally get a glimmer that this isn't just some weird weekly world news headline, right? That this isn't some tabloid report that can be dismissed with one of those, oh, there they go again to sell some newspapers. When our government really began to sit up and take notice that something was happening that may never have happened ever before.
Well, our government knew, we know, at least a year before the Great Panic.
Okay. They knew a whole year before.
They knew a whole year before. And to their credit, they did at least try to react. But you have to remember where America was at that point. They just did not have the resources. Americans had just had 8 years of a government that really stripped the government, stripped the economy, stripped the military. We were exhausted. We were tired. We were angry and frustrated. Nobody wanted to sacrifice anything more.
So the kind of reading the tea leaves on that, they thought the American people don't have the appetite for this. Even if we did tell them, it wouldn't be received. So let's go ahead and just send some money, throw some money at the problem, send over some academics. What's the first thing that our country does when it finally snaps into action a little bit?
Well, initially the idea was to respond in Africa. They believed it was African rabies. So the idea was to try and exterminate the sources in Africa, sending covert teams in country. That was one. The other one was trying to remove any of the threats that were coming into the country, but it was easily too little too late.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about threats coming into the country. Explain what that means. I mean, because they had already tried to set up, you know, checkpoints to catch people who had, you know, the swine flu, and to try and catch people who had SARS, and to try to and you know, obviously that was that almost was sort of an interesting precursor for this. But
well, people had had enough of that. People had had enough of checkpoints and taking their shoes off and discovering their phones were being tapped and their emails read. And it ruined the credibility in the very same way that Watergate had ruined the credibility of the government in the 1970s.
Right.
In the very same way, actually, that the Vietnam War had destroyed America's morale for a long-term conflict.
Right. Right. We were anxious for mourning in America again, if
That's
you will.
That's exactly where we were. We wanted our mourning, and no politician was going to tell us that twilight was giving way to darkness.
Right, that there was The Walking Dead, and is there any part of that which is kind of xenophobic anyway, where we're just sort of feeling like, well, that's their problem, that's not going to come around here, that's something they're going to have to deal with? I mean, was there any of that in the U.S. government at the time?
Well, I think that's always there. That's always there. America has always been an isolationist country, and always getting votes is important. Remember, you know, the politicians, the ones that knew, still had to answer to their constituents. And there's a very big difference between what they knew was right morally and whether they were going to lose their seat in the next election. And that's very important.
You know, we're coming up to the bottom of the hour, so there's so many questions still to get to with Max Brooks here about the history of World War Z. It's an oral history, so it's you know, there are individual stories from around the world, but when you put them all together, that tells the whole story to a larger degree than has been successfully done, I think. Max, let me ask you, if you can, just in a quick, give me 60 seconds on what the earliest zombies, how they were being described. How do people describe them? And did it change at all during the course of World War Z?
Well, of course it did. It began with human beings who were simply sick, with some sort of virus, rabies, and by the end, we knew that these were dead bodies waking to kill and consume us.
But did they were they being described in terms of how they were acting differently? Like at the beginning, did they just say, well, they're just kind of catatonic, and then they became murderous? Or did people understand at the very beginning that you if you saw one, you had to run?
Well, initially, no. Initially, the idea was if a loved one you know is ill, be careful. They may not recognize you. They may be paranoid. They may lash out.
Right. Because I think that's so much part of the story. That's definitely what I was getting at, is that feeling that people had that this could still be treated. So some of the blame for this outbreak has to go not just into the realm of the political, but also the medical as well. And we'll get to all of that coming up. The oral history of the zombie war. Many of you lived it all too well. I know that many people lost loved ones to this, but we're going to talk about it anyway tonight. It's World War Z on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, he's doing here with the book World War Z, an oral history of the zombie war, what Studs Terkel did for World War II. And if you pardon the expression, he's putting flesh on the bones of something which a lot of us are still processing, still trying to understand what happened after the Great Panic. We'll get into that coming up here in just a minute. And some of the unique aspects of the zombie war that heretofore tonight you might have just thought of as just rumor, but they really did happen. And we'll tell you about some of those important events, including how we were able to, both as a country and as a world, turn the tide in this war back into the favor of the living instead of the living dead. World War Z continues with Max Brooks, historian, on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Almost within a month of the New York Times publishing again for the first time in many years, they made World War Z a New York Times bestseller. It will be a movie coming up soon, and it's helpful, I think, for people to begin to understand what happened during the zombie war. Max Brooks was originally brought in to write the UN post-war commission report. And then when they didn't allow him to use, you know, the human piece of that to really talk about some of the ways in which individuals were affected, he was allowed to write this book. And it's interesting, too, Max, because you were kind of known already. I mean, when you had written the Zombie Survival Guide, I think a lot of people dismissed that as a joke. They just said that was kind of, you know, kind of a funny thing. But you had written the Zombie Survival Guide, which ended up being sort of a Bible for a lot of people during this crazy time.
Well, I wish, let me put it this way. I wish it were a joke, and I wish I had been wrong.
Yeah. So, you're talking about the kind of bigotry of the African rabies, that people sort of dismissed this as something which is happening over there. And again, you know, we can send some aid. But where was the CDC on doing, like, tissue samples right away? From The Walking Dead, why didn't they airlift in mass and try to stop this much earlier on?
Money. It all comes down to that. We were exhausted. It would have been as if the Soviets had launched a massive invasion of Western Europe in the 1970s.
Right. I so see that. You're just saying that people weren't in the mood. They couldn't.
Yeah.
They didn't want to do it. They would have been like, let them sort it out. That's not going to affect us. Who cares?
I'm saying that our days of sacrifice and of unity were long over.
Interestingly enough, Israel took this very seriously early on. And I think that, again, when we start talking about some of the ways different countries reacted, it reveals a little bit about their national character. But also sometimes it's just a matter of, there's a certain amount of luck involved too. But Israel had an interesting response in that they were already kind of an isolated country. I mean, they were already slightly surrounded. So maybe they were in a better position than others. Can you talk about Israel's response?
Well, I think that for us in the United States, national defense is an option. And for Israel, it's a necessity. I think that until The Walking Dead, we really did not have something that threatened our country. For us, wars are fought over there. Even terrorist attacks cannot destroy our country.
Right.
Israel, on the other hand, is living on the razor's edge. And so, therefore, they were always in a high state of alert.
And so in a high state of alert, and then how did that get lived out? When they started to, when there, as you said, the Mossad was one of the, kind of one of the early adapters of this new, you know, just sort of developing problem. They understood what was going on before anybody else did. What, how did they start to do things differently in Israel that kept it from being the victim that so many other nations were?
Well, they did exactly what we should have done. They had a national call to arms. That was the first thing they did. They took their security fence and simply extended it around the entire country. Every citizen made tremendous sacrifices, and their most controversial decision was to allow right of return for those who had formerly lived in Palestine, which, of course, as we all know, sparked off the Israeli civil war.
But, and you say anybody who lived in Palestine, because that means Palestinians, and it means people who had left to go live in other parts of the country. When they found out that Israel was a safe place, boy, did they change their tune.
Well, you know, there was the Israeli decision was, as in everything in Israel, both moral and practical. Morally, because it simply was the right thing to do. And practically, because you have hundreds of thousands of people that, when Z-Day happens, are either going to be safe inside with you or clamoring to get in.
Right.
And so that was one of the things that sparked off the civil war.
And talk about that a little bit for people who were obviously cut off for a period of time and unable to get the news on that about the civil war. But that's not uncommon. That was that was something that was going on in a lot of different places. Unrest about how the government was reacting, but it was different in Israel.
Well, in Israel, there was once again a practical decision to abandon Jerusalem simply because it is too big and too hard to control. And as is the corridor leading to Jerusalem. So the idea was to shorten the barrier and retreat to 1967 borders, simply because it's a smaller border and easier to maintain. Well, the religious right in Israel went berserk and rose up en masse. And this had been festering for years, even before the dead rose. And it simply came down to secular Israel versus religious fundamentalist Israel. And
right. Lucky
for all of us, secular Israel won.
Yeah. Well, that's so interesting. In fact, we were just talking about that a little while ago on Coast to Coast about some of the factionalism that goes on when it comes to Jerusalem and the amount of how tempers can so easily flare around the Wailing Wall or around the Temple on the Mount. What about the Jewish-Muslim dynamic in Jerusalem at the time?
Well, I think what happened was the Muslim element was almost forgotten for the months that the Civil War was happening. And the only reason secular Israel won is because many of the extreme religious people in Israel do not serve in the army and had no military training.
Right. So was there a difference in the way Islam reacted right away to this early onset of zombieism? I mean, because they were closer to some of the flashpoints anyway. And I say they, meaning that many of the countries that were affected were Muslim nations predominantly. Did they react differently than, say, secular nations or Christian nations?
Well, it wasn't as much religious as it was political.
Okay.
If you're referring to the nuclear exchange between Iran and Pakistan, that was simply bad luck between two countries that did not have a good communication network and never conceived that they would have gone to war.
Well, yeah, it seemed like some of the character that sort of dominates the government may have been influenced by religious interests, and I'm not casting aspersion saying that one was right and the other was wrong. Obviously, nobody wanted that war, and it was over the bridges. And you think they would have been able to have communicated that, but at the same time, you think somehow in there, built into that, there's a bunch of other sort of ancient religious differences going on between, and sort of distrust that's based on kind of the traditions that that are particular to those countries.
Well, you know, that's what one school of thought believes. But really, when you talk to the survivors, and unfortunately, it really came down to a breakdown in communication.
That's all.
I mean, I think that makes it even more horrific for some people.
Go ahead, and but I didn't mean to stop you from before, but the communication was about the bridges. To explain what we, because that was too, was sort of a misguided, maybe,
simply
maybe not.
That refugees from Pakistan were flowing into Iran. The Iranians tried to stop them, beg the Pakistanis to close the borders. Pakistani couldn't, even if they'd wanted to. The Iranians responded by bombing the bridges across the border. The Pakistanis, now we, when I say the Pakistanis, we don't even know if it was the central government. It might have been garrison commanders in the region.
Right.
Launched a counterattack.
Right.
And it escalated. And here, this is the most important thing. Countries like India and Pakistan that might have a nuclear war, like the U.S. and Russia, have machinery set up to shut it down. They have phone lines between the capitals. They have diplomatic protocols. They train for this like a fire drill. Any house that can catch fire has a smoke alarm. They never believed that Iran and Pakistan would ever go to war, let alone nuclear. So there was no hotline. There was no diplomatic protocol. There was no way to turn it off.
Well, and of course, at a time like this, we can understand it. We're talking about World War Z, the oral history of the zombie war written by Max Brooks. We can understand when fear takes over. Fear is inherently irrational. But there's also, again, there's sort of this luck factor that comes into it, because certain countries just seem to have got a break where other countries didn't. And then you have some of these various tragedies that can happen. Even in the United States, once the outbreak came here, there was just some bad luck. And then there was other people who just happened to fortunately be west of the Rockies. They did better. And talk about that a little bit. Why certain parts of the United States, why were they affected so fast and overwhelmed before they could even begin to stand up against the living dead?
Well, in most warfare, when you're losing, it's very prudent to retreat and establish a safe zone and rebuild and rearm. And that is exactly what the U.S. government did. That's what many countries did. And unfortunately, it was easier to withdraw behind the Rocky Mountains to the west than it was to the east. There was simply, it was an easier country to defend,
right,
the eastern part of the U.S. And those who were caught on the other side were out of luck.
Yeah. But did any of that have to do with the number of port cities? I mean, how is it that the eastern part of the country got infected faster, or seemingly got infected faster than the rest of the country?
Well, they actually were infected at the same time. The difference is the terrain of the West Coast of the United States is much rougher, and it is also easier to close down. There, you also have, in addition to the mountains, you have these tremendous deserts.
Right.
And it's simple fact that huge swaths of the American West is uninhabited, as opposed to the American East, which is very densely populated and easy to move through. So it's simply easier for zombies to cross the flatlands of the Midwest than it is to cross the Rockies.
Do we have any scientific proof of adaptation within the zombie community, as it were? I mean, do we see any evidence at all of them being able to learn things or be able to function higher as time went on in the zombie war?
No, there was none of that, but there was a lot of misconceptions where people were confusing them with Quislings or with ferals.
Explain that, because I'm sure some people may be unfamiliar with that vocabulary.
Well, we'll start with Quislings. Quislings are human beings who psychologically cannot deal with the concept of kill or be killed. There must be a middle ground. There must be a way to negotiate. There must be a way to surrender. And their minds literally cracked and became zombie-like. And they took on the personality of the living dead.
And this in the sense of the incoherence, the apparent incoherence, not so much about characteristics, meaning that they weren't trying to eat people.
They were. They actually were.
I said earlier that this is one of those, I thought that was just a rumor.
No, they did. They did. They tried to eat people, and they were just as dangerous in that you could die of a staph infection from their teeth, just as well as there are more germs in the human mouth than there are in a dog. So they were a threat.
And then the ferals?
The ferals were children who had been abandoned by their parents or who had fled and who had lived in the wilderness and somehow managed to survive, but either took on the personality of the animals or acted in an animalistic fashion themselves. And so when you hear people talk about running zombies, they were really talking about ferals.
Hmm. Because the rest of the zombies couldn't move that fast.
No, the zombies are slow moving.
That was the misconception about the evolution, that they were evolving.
Yeah, no. Anyone who says they were attacked by a fast zombie were attacked by a feral.
And some of this information, I think, is just getting cleared up for the first time. If you want to link up to Max Brooks, you can through our website. It's back up again, coasttocoastam.com. World War Z is the book. So, what are we talking about? The numbers. I mean, I know you didn't want to focus so much on the numbers because that's what's in the United Nations post-war commission report. But, you know, a lot of us didn't really believe the numbers. We were having a hard time kind of getting our head around these numbers, but explain what the loss of life during the zombie war was, and how much it was directly lost to the zombies as opposed to collateral damage.
Well, there were so many ways a human could die. Statistically, you were easily as likely to die from starvation or from conventional disease or even from dehydration. We talked about the deserts. Many people did try to cross into the western United States. And to this day, the deserts of the American Southwest are littered with the bones of refugees who didn't make it. Even hypothermia, those from Canada. You could die from industrial accidents, from fires. Many people were safe and secure, boarded up in homes, and died as fires raged through their neighborhoods. Many people died when their own governments tried to use military force.
Right.
There were many ways to die.
And the final figures, what are the percentages?
We still don't know. There are still parts of the world that we consider white zones, which they are still infested. I will say this, that the problems of the pre-war world, overpopulation and not enough food to go around, not enough resources, we don't have that problem anymore.
Yeah, unfortunately. In the worst case scenario, some countries have seen, like China got reduced down to, I've heard stories of what, 100,000?
That was just in Chongqing. Chongqing
okay.
Was reduced to that.
Do we know what, I mean, the countries that were hit earliest and hardest, did any of them survive the zombie war intact? Or did they all end up, you know, changing governments, changing their political systems, changing their military leaders? I mean, did anybody come through it unscathed?
Well, Cuba, that's one.
That's true.
Cuba, we all know Cuba won the peace in the very same way that the winner of the Cold War between the United States and Soviet Union was Japan. Some countries just win by default.
Right. There's that luck factor again.
Well, part of it was luck. They were an island. Had they been landlocked, it probably would have been different. But remember, they also were an island under siege. They had a totalitarian government, they had a strong military, and they were prepared to deal with an invasion. They just didn't expect it to be American boat people.
Right. I think that's still hard for a lot of people to get their mind around, that we were going to them for help.
Well, you know, it was very hard for the British in the First and Second World Wars to believe that they had to come to us for help. And the truth was, we were a safe haven. We were the arsenal of democracy, and that turned out to be the case with Cuba. They were the arsenal of survival.
Right. And Japan didn't nearly do as well this time.
No, Japan evacuated, which you could say was a victory in itself, that it was such an orderly evacuation. There was no mass looting, rioting, deaths like there were in the rest of the world. Organized lotteries, all heading to Kamchatka and other places. So.
Right.
But still that, many deaths.
And we don't have, and I guess we shouldn't be surprised, we just don't have any idea what happened in North Korea.
No, we still don't.
Meaning that there's just no word that comes out at all?
That if you see satellite pictures of that country, which are available online, you will see that it is deserted. It is as if every citizen of that country literally disappeared.
Now, what about the rumor that they just went underground?
That is probably the most plausible rumor. That's the one that most people believe, And it's probably true. The question is, what happened underground? That
meaning?
Meaning, are they still there? Are they living in solitude? Are they, do they have a subterranean civilization down there, which is theoretically possible? Or did the infection go down there with them?
You know, I we're coming up to the top of the hour, and there's so many more questions to get to with Max Brooks, author of World War Z, an oral history of the zombie war. But I just want to say real quickly, I guess I don't know whether they're just rumors. I had heard, though, that a couple of prominent journalists had attempted to get behind the lines again, much like we've seen in the last couple of years, with journalists trying to get cute kind of and sort of get pictures inside North Korea, and nobody has ever heard from them again.
No, and you could blame zombies, but it's probably more likely landmines.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's where we stand then in our first hour with Max Brooks. There's more to get to. I want to deal with some of the myths of the zombie wars, and then the sad truths of what happened, and some of the heroes and some of the villains who came through this that he had a chance to meet and interview for World War Z next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.